module with more room up in the space station and leave it there. It's got a bunch of science racks on it. Rigged out to permanently stay on the space station, attached to the space station. And that's it for the manned space program. A couple more flights. Probably be over in July or August. When we drop it, WS. Resupplying of the shuttle is going on. In fact, you've asked that a number of times over the years. Recently, they had quite a few flights go up there. At the very end of January, you had the Japanese resupply ship took off from Japan, the H-2A, and went up there, successfully docked, unloaded equipment. The Progress pressure also went up a couple of days later, and that did the same, unloaded equipment. They years ago with two or just three. There's a lot of stuff that has to be taken out, and many tons of equipment that has to be removed from these cargo vehicles, including the space shuttle when it goes up. Another one that went up is the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle built by European Space Agency. That just went up recently, launched from Corgo in South America, French Guiana. Northern part of South America, they have a whole spaceport built by European Space Agency, and they've got a heavy lift vehicle that puts this thing up there. They call it the Johannes Kepler. They named it after him. When I first saw this thing, I said, "Well, there is a Kepler up there. There's a Kepler Space Telescope." But that's not it. That's just, you know, they just use the same name. Drop it. Another unmanned vehicle, completely autonomous, docked to the space station itself. They've done this one other time before, and they've got another maybe half dozen so or more flights contracted out for the next quite a few years to resupply the space station. Brings literally tons up. I mean, it's just the whole weight of this spacecraft is 22 tons. It's a big thing. And that's why they need the Ariane 5 launch vehicle down in South America to put this thing into orbit. And that probably carries about three times the amount of weight that either the Japanese or the Russian resupply vehicle can handle. It's pretty much it for the International Space Station. Stardust on the 14th. Valentine's Day passed Tempo 1. Tempo 1 is a comet that's been visited before by a spacecraft called Deep Impact. You might remember that about 5-6 years ago. Deep Impact sent another spacecraft from itself. You know, Deep Impact was like the mother craft, and it sent another craft about 800 pounds. Slamming into Tempo 1, southern part of it. Well, looking at the picture anyway, it looks like the bottom part of the comet. And they expected to see the crater there. They saw dust and everything fly off, and they never did see a crater. And because of the dust, it obscured the vision of it. They wanted to see this crater that was created. So with Stardust, they figured here it is years later, maybe they'll be able to take a picture of it. Well, behold, no picture. Why no picture? They believe what happened is after this 800...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I gotta watch the timeout stick. That was supposed to happen this month, AR, ISS-1. But, due to certain EVA problems, the workload that they have, they're not going to do it until probably next July. Last month we talked about the space telescope, the New Star telescope that was going to be launched next year, 2012. Well, next 1 year away, we have the big telescope, the big one, the one essentially replacing the Hubble, which will be replacing the Hubble, the JWST, the infrared telescope. Space telescope. That thing is going to be going up a couple of years from now. It's got to be, instead of cryogenically cooling the telescope, which normally they would do with infrared, they're going to put it out really into deep space, about four times the distance of the moon. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope, named after him. Guy James Webb, he was like a NASA administrator that really pushed the space program back in the 60s. So, by putting it at that distance, at the L2, they call it Lagrange 2 point, which is a million miles out from Earth, Earth will always be between the sun and the telescope. So try to keep it as cool as possible to get it down to near cryogenically absolute zero number as they can.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They're looking for galaxies with this James Webb telescope at the beginning of time, really. They're going back 13.5 billion years. Any kind of heat would foul up the telescope. Works in infrared. We see violet and red. This thing is in the infrared area. You're going to get pictures back that are going to be unbelievable once this is up there. The shade made by DuPont. It's called Captus, K-A-P-T-O-N, that's the material. It's very, very thin. Sheets in it, and it's like five different layers separated from each other to keep the telescope cool. It's as thin as one guy reported, a 1/3 of a human hair. Very thin stuff. It's really captive material mixed up with a little aluminum. So should be interesting. It's big. It's a big thing. It's a Hubble. You put a person standing next to it. I think it's about 8 feet in diameter. This thing, overall square footage is about seven times square footage bigger than the Hubble. And it's got to drop it.
Everything just right. It looks like an engineering nightmare.
Back to your deck chair. A little long this week, but quite a bit to cover. WS2.
Yeah, after your description, I've got to go look up that James Webb. I've been hearing about it, but I didn't go and actually look at the details. That sounds like quite a machine. At Lagrange Point number 2, which is roughly a million miles on the opposite side of the Sun. It's away from the Earth. It's in orbit, you could say, with the Earth, but on a million miles deeper in space, away from the Sun, with that tennis court-sized sunshade. Wow. Okay, let's go over to the deeper stuff, but before we do, I know that Hal wanted to make a quick comment. K6DPZ, if you're still there, Hal, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, thank you. K2RIW, K6DPZ. I was going to leave. I just wanted to make a comment about the Richards Problem 62S1. First of all, to make the measurements of the grid drive going on the 4CX250B, we use a Boonton 92C RMS voltmeter with a probe on it. It's 100 to 1. So we get a very accurate RF voltage reading right in at the grid without loading. Now, as far as the output tank, to be able to check that output tank, very simple. Take the B-plus off the output tank, run the filaments, take a MFJ 10 analyzer, shove it in backwards on the tank circuit at 50 ohm point, and get a 1-to-1 standing wave at the operating frequency. And you can check that the tank is working on VHF properly to match 50 ohm impedance, as well as on 6 meters and on 2 meters. The same procedure you could use for both. Yeah, go ahead.
When you feed the standing wave ratio meter backwards into the output of the amplifier, the tube itself is being, the filament is on. I had the impression the B-plus is on. If the B-plus is off, the tube is just a pure capacitance. You can find resonance, but you won't find the right loading because the tube is not providing a load. Maybe I misunderstood you on that one, Hal. Go ahead.
One thing I forgot. Your throw resistor is about 1,500 ohms. From the plate of the tube to ground, you don't need any B+. As a matter of fact, you can do it with cold without filaments. So that's assuming the plate and load impedance of the tube looking into the 50 ohm load. You're using a reverse pi, and you get a match. If you have the match, the tank circuit is properly working. If you can't get the match, then you have a problem with the tank. Go ahead.
Yeah, you didn't mention the 1,500 ohm resistor. You said turn on the filaments, and that was a little bit confusing. And yes, the Pi network must obey the law of reciprocity, so whatever impedance it provides when it's matching a 1,500 ohm source impedance of a tube through the Pi into the 50 ohm antenna transmission line and feeding it backwards to the 50 ohm instrumentation, your Viswa measuring instrument, looking backwards into the Pi, into the 1,500 ohm resistor, should see a match, both resonance and the proper resistive component. Sounds good. Yeah, I think once he gets used to having a good 4CX250B or a good 4X150 and the right voltages on it, he's going to get all the steam he wants out of that thing as long as his power supply can take it. In other words, as I see it, once that amplifier is working correctly, it provides the nest that makes the tube happy. And then what power output you get is strictly a function of what voltages and drives you give to the tube. And now your only argument that's left is between you and the tube manufacturer, so to speak. That's the way I look at it. Okay, when it comes to magnetic circuits, first of all, if you guys have tried to mail me any emails during the last week, I had a bit of a problem. I had a crash of a computer Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Finally, all got fixed Saturday evening, so I might be missing some emails if you guys did try to mail me some. But I found an article that I would have liked to have told you guys about if I had a working computer. And let me drop. You guys may have found this article already. It's a fairly long email address, a URL. It's labeled Nuclear Magnetic Resonance. And maybe it's one that Wesley has mailed me earlier. If you simply Google the word nuclear magnetic resonance, and of all the responses you'll get, the one that begins with http://hyperphysics.physics-astr.gsu and so on. So the one that begins with hyperphysics is a very authoritative looking website, and it shows me that what makes magnetic field. There are four sources of magnetic field. Proton spin is one of the sources. Electron spin is one of the sources. Current loop magnetic moment, in other words, the electrons going in orbit around the nucleus, is one of the sources. That's number three in my list. And four is the so-called bar magnet magnetic moment. And that one may only be relevant to NMR imaging. But there's at least three sources of magnetic field, and there's four sources of the method by which stored energy of the magnetic field of a element or of a molecule can take place. So proton spin, electron current loop, and then the magnetic moment. So when we go to that particular website, I think it gives us a little more information, at least it did for me. Let me turn it over to you first, John, because I know you've got some more questions, and then Wesley in that order. KC2 WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Okay, Dick, if that's the case, when we say we align the domains, what do you think they're talking about? The actual position of electrons and the orbits of the electron or the cloud of the electron? What is the constituents of the domain?
John, good question. And right now I don't know. I'd like to believe that when you get a neodymium iron boron magnet, there's ones that are super strong. They're not only super strong in the total magnetic field, but they're super strong in their coercivity. In other words, we used to worry in the old days about an Alnico magnet that was on a circulator, a microwave circulator or isolator, that if you brought a screwdriver or a pair of pliers nearby, you would degauss it a small amount and you would tune it to some other frequency. They are now making super small circulators and isolators, you know, 1/100th the area or volume of the old ones at microwave frequencies, and they no longer tell you to be careful about bringing a screwdriver or a pair of pliers nearby. They don't worry about degaussing anymore. These new magnets have got tremendous coercivity. And in order to get such a strong magnetic field, I am of the belief that at least two or three of those modes of making magnetic fields are all working for you in parallel. I'd like to believe that when you align those domains, I got to prove this. I don't know this yet. I'd like to believe that you're aligning the proton spin, you're aligning the electron spin, and you're aligning the current loop of the orbits. I think you're aligning all three of those. Without doing all three, I'm having trouble believing you would get such a fiercely strong magnetic field. But that's a guess on my part, and it's going to take some more research. As you can tell, anybody listening to these series of TechNets that began a few months ago, there's a bunch of the blind leading the blind here. We really have all started off with a lot of lack of knowledge at the molecular level, and we'd like to know what Mother Nature is really telling us. We're slowly walking our way through the woods here. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You're right, Dick. Extreme lack of knowledge on this end, that's for sure. Also, I'd like you to think about what maintains the domain once it's set, and why doesn't that happen in other elements other than iron with its 26 electrons or whatever? Just something to think about. I've been trying to formulate some questions, and I haven't been too successful this week to keep it simple and look at the most simple part of the magnet, and I know Wesley has some questions too, but it's just something for you to think about, Dick.
Just an addition to the question of John, and it would be, if you give the answer to John of any kind, how would you relate that answer magnetic field that is produced by copper wire. And do it.
Yeah, this particular website does say that. It does give an example of that exact one, that the current loop around each individual nucleus of the electrons creates a magnetic field that can be aligned in these domains, and that it is the movement of electrons creating a current that by Faraday's law makes a magnetic field by the so-called right-hand rule. You aim your thumb in the direction of the electron motion, assuming the electrons are positively charged particles. You got to go through a little bit of a rigmarole on that one. But assuming that the current flow is the movement of positively charged particles, that the current flows from the positive terminal to the negative terminal of a circuit. Under that assumption, if your thumb is in the direction of current flow, and your fingers curl around the wire, that's where the magnetic field forms. And I found a couple of these websites that give you beautiful color pictures of what magnetic fields look like. The two wires side by side, and wires in a solenoid coil. Let me drop this. Wires wound in a solenoid coil, wires wound in a toroidal coil in air. This is before you add the magnetic material nearby to give you a greater strengthening, reduction of the reluctance of the path, which makes the same number of ampere turns create a magnetic field. Overly coincidental that this week what came up at the salt mine is that somebody wants to make a very large area magnetic field. And he's willing to wrap a wire around this very large area, and he's asking the question, how many turns of wire and how many amperes flowing will give you what strength of magnetic field? And many of us are very light on that before we start digging into it. But the current, once electrons flow, whether the electron is flowing in a circular path around the nucleus or whether it's flowing in a linear, by the way, that circular path, let me backtrack. When the current flows in a copper wire, by right-hand rule, you get current, you get magnetic field following your fingers. And the usual reference, the usual standard is that you assume the lines of magnetic force start at the North Pole and go toward the South Pole. That's the usual assumption. So current moving in the wire gives you a circular magnetic field around that wire. Turn the wire into a solenoid coil, and now each of those turns of the coil, let me drop, each of those turns of the coil give you reinforcement of the magnetic field that's now being generated down the center axis of the solenoid coil. But on each individual wire of the coil, it's still following this right-hand rule. So that one all comes together. So current flowing in a circular pattern in that solenoid coil creates a reinforced, stronger magnetic field. And they then sometimes go the next step of creating a so-called magnetic sheath that's in the same vicinity of the individual turns. And with the right mathematics, that all comes out right. So now as I see it, the movement of a charged particle, that's what current is, automatically gives you magnetic field by Lenz's law. And if the current is now flowing in a circular pattern, like it does in a solenoid, you get reinforcement. If it's flowing in a circular pattern, like it does with the electrons flowing around a nucleus, the cloud of electrons around each individual nucleus, you're getting a magnetic field, again following the right-hand rule.
But a problem that I had was that if you imagine that you have a 5 amperes in 12 volts flowing through the conductor, and it is giving you a certain magnetic field, and then you have a magnet, nothing is flowing through it, it internally short-circuits the way that Glenn described it, and represents 50 times greater power. Why in the world is that happening?
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Wesley, that in order for you and I to have real elements or molecules, by definition, there's a cloud of electrons around a nucleus for each individual atom or each individual molecule. There's a cloud of electrons flowing. And when you magnetize the material, and we call those individual areas domains, and you align all those domains, you're getting a stronger than normal magnetic field. So the nature of the way a molecule is constructed, I'm led to believe that every molecule at the microscopic level has a tiny amount of magnetic field. But in most molecules, the individual molecules have what you and I would consider random orientation, and those individual magnetic fields do not add up. For the materials that you and I can make magnetic, like a diamagnetic material, in other words, a magnetic material that naturally is not magnetized, but I can put a magnetic field externally to it, and I can force these individual domains, individual molecules, individual atoms to align, I get a stronger magnetic field during that time. And if the material has very little retentivity and I remove the external magnetic field, that particular material jumps back to the random orientation. The things that you and I call a steady state magnet are the ones that once I align them, they sort of have a whole lot of friction, so to speak, between the individual domains, and once I align them, they stay aligned. They lock in space. They lock in place. So to some degree, I think every material has some magnetic quality at the microscopic, at the atomic level, but the material...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So to repeat, I think at the atomic level, I think every material has some magnetic properties. But the materials you and I care about most are the ones that once you align those individual atoms and molecules, they stay aligned. Those are the ones that you and I call a permanent magnet. Now, your next question, I think, is going to be, did I put energy into that system when I did that? I think the answer is yes. And could I get that energy back out of it if I collapse that magnetic field? I think the answer is yes. But during the time the magnetic field is there, energy is not flowing in my mind. It's a little bit like compressing a spring. I put energy into a spring and I compress it. And now I put some kind of a rope around the spring to keep it compressed. It has potential energy. And if at some later time I release that rope around the spring, I can get that energy back out. But during the time that the spring is compressed, it's continuously making force against the rope, in my example, but that's not dissipating power. That's not dissipating energy. It's just stored potential energy. By the same token, in a aligned magnetic material, I have stored potential energy. The best example I can think of that, in the LHC, the Large Hadronic Collider, they did have a cryogenic failure 2 years ago. And when that particular superconducting magnet went into non-superconducting conditions and that magnetic field collapsed, they got all of that huge amount of energy back and it burned up a lot of their wiring. So when the magnetic field is increasing or decreasing, energy is flowing. But during the time that huge magnetic field is there, it, in my mind, is a little bit like a compressed spring. Maybe that helps a little bit. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. What is for me amazing is that at one situation when you're using the copper coil, we use watts, kilowatts of power in order to maintain the magnetic field, if it's in our interest to keep it. On the other hand, we deal with the magnetic field that does not need any kind of energy because it does create a steady magnetic field. that we can utilize, and it's many times more of that one that we have created. Glenn has got a video from him, from me, also you two and John, and it was a quite a controversial video, and I would like, and he sent me the email saying that it was very interesting to him to see that approach. I would like to have Glenn to take a stand if he can, and to actually.
Now, I'm going to go back one step, though, Glenn. I mean, Wesley. When current flows through a copper wire, you said kilowatts are being dissipated to make a magnetic field. I agree with you. But the kilowatts are dissipating only because the copper wire has resistance. If I'm willing to take that exact same current through that solenoid coil of that copper wire that's making that magnetic field, and I douse that copper wire into a cooling substance, assuming the copper wire has superconducting capability, and I now make that wire go to zero resistance by cryogenically cooling it, the current I'm putting through the wire now requires zero power. I can take the current, I put it into the wire, it makes a magnetic field, I take the two ends of the wire where the power supply is, and I bring them together, I short them out. And if the wire is superconducting, the current will flow through that copper wire forever with no power required to make that external magnetic field by way of the current flowing into the copper wire.
Calculating how much power do you need to keep that cryogenically cold? How much power would be that? Would that be more exactly the same or less than the power that you previously used for the circuit to create that particular magnetic field?
You put it out of space with the telescope, that would be all the way down to almost absolute zero WS2.
Yeah, Paul's got a good suggestion there. The cryogenic power is not power in the direct sense. If I've got a great big vat of liquid helium and I keep pouring the liquid helium in there as it boils off, am I putting power in there? Well, it took a lot of power for me to refine tremendous amounts of atmosphere in order to get that vat full of liquid helium. I'll give you that. But the power that I'm putting in with the liquid helium to keep the cryogenic temperature, I'm only putting in that power because my insulation isn't good enough. I live in a warm environment, and the heat of my environment is continuously flowing through the insulation into my cryogenic coil and is trying to heat it up. If I got a better and better blanket, I use less and less liquid helium to keep the cryogenic temperature, to keep the superconductivity. If I lived in the right place out in space, like where the James Webb telescope is going to be, and I've got this great big sun shield that is a tennis court in diameter made out of Kapton, and now in that environment at Lagrange point number 2, I've shielded myself from the sun and I'm looking at nothing but the cold background of space. In that environment, if my sun shield is good enough, let me drop. If my sun shield is good enough, I am now living in a 3-degree Kelvin environment, minus 267 degrees centigrade. Now I don't have to pour in liquid helium. I don't have to do anything. It'll sit there forever, cryogenically cooled. So the power I put into the refrigeration and the liquid helium is only compensating for my less than ideal insulating blanket and the fact that I live in a warm environment. So it's not, that power is not required to maintain the magnetic field. That power is only required to compensate for my warm environment and my less than perfect insulation. I wonder if that makes some sense, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Question.
Go ahead, John. number one, I'm not convinced that copper is one of those materials that experiences superconductivity. And if it does, maybe it only does get superconductive at 0.001 Kelvin, and that's very difficult to get to.
But see, at that temperature, it is becoming superconductive. Question is, it is becoming, or isn't becoming, a line.
WS2N6, they got the ceramic, is it around minus 300?
Yeah, they're a much better so-called high-temperature superconducting materials, which happen to be ceramics. So I don't have to be quite as cold if I got the right material. And I think they are using some of these materials in the LHC magnets for that great big accelerator over there in Switzerland. To answer John's question, can I align the individual domains of the copper wire to make them into a magnet? And there's two answers to that one, John. Assuming that copper does become superconducting at some particular temperature that I can get to, and maybe the answer is half a degree Kelvin. So I can make my copper superconducting. I can put a current through a solenoid coil, or maybe just one turn. But I got some number of turns of copper wire, and I put current through it while it is superconducting, and I close the circuit. The current that I put through there will flow forever, and the current will make a magnetic field. It's a magnetic field because of current flowing through the copper, regardless of what goes on at the molecular level in the copper itself. Now, copper itself, I think it might be a paramagnetic material, not a diamagnetic material. It's certainly not a ferromagnetic material. In other words, I cannot permanently magnetize copper. I'm sure of that. Can I get a little bit of magnetic characteristic if I put a chunk of copper in a strong magnetic field? There I'm not sure. But so I can make that copper create a magnet with cryogenics and current that I put in, and that current stays there forever. So there's at least two ways I can make a magnetic field in a chunk of copper. And now can I do it at the molecular level? I don't know. That's going to require a little more research. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick, because I was thinking if we took it out in space in that cold temperature and we did magnetize it and remove that wire, if the domains would stay put, being that they're not supposed to have any motion at that temperature, just something to think about.
Dick, WS2N.
Now, I think that anything that current will flow through, any semiconductor, any partially conducting copper rod, I mean a carbon rod, a carbonized piece of thread, copper, aluminum, gallium, molybdenum, anything that I can make current flow through, if I make it into a current loop and put current through it, I'm going to get a magnetic field. I'm getting a magnetic field because current is flowing, and by Faraday's law, I'm making a magnetic field. Even if I'm not doing it at the molecular level, at the atomic level of that material. But there are certain kinds of materials where I can do it at the atomic level, and it's got coercivity, that once I do this alignment of these domains, they lock themselves in space, and until I get up to the Curie temperature, they stay locked there. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, did you ever see these materials that they cryogenically cool? They throw a current through it, and they disconnect it, just like what John's saying, except they keep it cryogenically cool. Once the current is going through it, it creates a magnetic field, and they always show it floating, usually like a cube type of thing. It's just floating a couple of inches above the... floating in midair. And they said as long as you keep that area cryogenically cool, it would float. And if you come up with a room temperature material that would be superconductive, again, that would float forever. Dick, thank you.
Yeah, I got a beautiful explanation for that. Is there another person that wants to join us? I'm hearing him, I've heard him break in twice. Who was that? Give me your call, letters, and name, sir. K2RIW. You talked on top of me. Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW. My name is Dick. Go ahead. Who is that person that wants to join us? Do it now. Okay. In the case of that floating magnetic, YouTube that we've all seen, and there's about 50 of them, if I've got a piece of, if I've got a solid chunk of material that is capable of becoming superconductive when it is cryogenically cooled, it now has eddy current capability and exclusivity. Let me explain what I mean by that. If I try putting a magnetic field into a shield that you and I have put around this transformer, for instance, I've got a really poor transformer. It's creating an external magnetic field. I've got some very delicate electronics nearby that can't tolerate that magnetic field. I've been in that environment. And you put this six-sided box of mu metal around the transformer. The mu metal is a kind of material that is both fairly conductive and it's fairly conductive as far as magnetic field is concerned. It's fairly conductive as far as electronic current is concerned. If a magnetic field wants to leave that box, in other words, the transformer is trying to make a magnetic field and it's trying to get out, the box is stopping the magnetic field by two techniques. Number one, the magnetic field will flow through the mu metal, the six-sided box, so extremely well, 1,000 times better than it flows through air, that all the magnetic field stays in that mu metal and never goes to the outside. That's one step. Let me drop. Now, every material, depending on its conductivity, has a so-called skin depth characteristic versus frequency. In other words, for every frequency, I go into a formula, and the formula's got a 1 over square root of a whole bunch of terms, but one of those terms is frequency. As I go to a lower and lower frequency, in the bottom of that denominator where I'm taking the square root of it, the depth of penetration gets deeper and deeper. If I go down to 60 hertz, the depth of penetration, I forget the number, but it might be 5/1000ths of an inch. And that's where the magnetic, that's where the skin depth, the current flows at that depth to 1 over E, which means 37% of the current has fallen, is left. 67% has gone away. I got it backwards. 63% has gone away, 37% is left for each individual skin depth. So I calculate what the skin depth of copper is at 60 hertz, and I put about 3 skin depths of copper. It's going to be a, you know, an eighth-inch thick chunk of copper as a six-sided box around that transformer. Assuming the copper has no magnetic properties at all, but it's highly conductive, and I've made a six-sided box, in order for a magnetic field to leave that copper box, it must be a changing magnetic field, because the transformer is running at 60 hertz. That's the 60 hertz changing magnetic field has to continuously, on each cycle, try to get through the copper. But the copper is a whole bunch of eddy current short circuits. I could take my felt tip 10, and somewhere on one side of the copper box, I draw a circle. And that particular circle of copper is acting like one shorted turn. And you try to change the magnetic field through one shorted turn, it's very difficult. You make one shorter turn on your transformer and you disturb the living daylights out of the transformer. So I can draw a million of these individual circles with my felt tip pen in that sheet of copper. And so if the sheet of copper is thick enough and the frequency is high...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
If the sheet of copper is thick enough and the frequency is high enough, the individual circles that are all making eddy current will not allow me to change the magnetic field. The reason why I've got a skin depth and a frequency sensitivity is because the copper has finite conductivity. If I now can make that copper box, the side of that copper box, cryogenic, where the current, where it becomes perfect in conductivity, I can now make that copper box as thin as I like, and no magnetic field can leave it. when you've got this solid chunk of black-looking, it looks like a hockey puck in the pictures that I've seen, of material that's capable of being superconductive. Once it becomes superconductive, it will not allow any change of magnetic field. If I do it while the magnet is there, and then I make it superconducting, I pick up the magnet, and that little hockey puck of superconducting material goes with the magnet. I'm picking it up. It won't allow a change in magnetic field. In order for me to extract that magnet from it, I would be decreasing the magnetic field that's already inside of it. So it allows no change. So I can be pushing down on the magnet. It won't. It'll resist my push because I'm trying to increase the magnetic field. Or I can pull up on the magnet, and again I'm trying to decrease, and it won't allow that to happen, and it follows me. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
Yes, it does, Dick. A lot of sense. That's very interesting about that U-metal and how that works. But I don't know if now what you're saying, if it can't change because of its temperature, and it's going to maintain that situation. That's why I was asking about the copper bar, but evidently the copper is not going to respond the same way you're talking just about superconductive material. But interesting concept.
Yeah, I wonder also what in molecular level is happening to the copper with respect to the eddies current in the temperature of superconductivity.
Let me go back one step now. In the case of that floating magnet, or in the case of the cryogenically cooled hockey puck, that I pick up the magnet and it follows me, Faraday's law or Lenz's law both tell me that if I've got a loop of wire, a loop of conductor of any kind, and I've got a magnetic field going through the center of that loop, the air in the center of that loop, any change in that magnetic field will induce a voltage in that wire. And it's a bidirectional thing. I change the magnet. In other words, I'm sliding a ball magnet through the loop of wire, and I've got the loop of wire going to a galvanometer, and as I push the magnet in, I'll see the galvanometer move to the right. I pull the magnet out, and I see the galvanometer move to the left. So Lenz's law and Faraday's law tells me that any change in magnetic field in a closed loop circuit must generate a voltage. Conversely, if I put a voltage, so to speak, across a conducting loop, it in turn generates a magnetic field. It's a bidirectional thing. Once I've got a conducting loop that will not allow any voltage drop because the conducting loop is superconducting, it will now not allow any change in magnetic field. I can't increase the magnetic field that's there. I can't decrease the magnetic field there without it fighting me. And so that hockey puck constitutes a whole lot of individual one-loop turns of superconducting material. There's a whole bunch of, in other words, I could take my felt-tip pen and I could draw a bunch of circles on the circular surface of that hockey puck. Each one of those is a conducting path that will not allow a magnetic field inside of that loop to change. Does that make a little more sense, though, John?
How the molecular structure at that temperature looks like?
That's a slightly different subject. Let me go to this one first. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I do hear a breaking station in there, but it's very weak. No, I understand what you're saying, Dick, and it's, again, it's very interesting. I understand when you're drawing those circles, and that makes me believe that if we had a copper wire and we placed it in a cryogenic situation and we induced a current, a closed loop, and we induced a current in it with a magnet, the wire would circulate and keep circulating the current and therefore generating a magnetic field and probably stay elevated or whatever it would do normally. That's my slant on it.
I agree with you. You got a beauty there. I make a continuous loop and I close it. So it's now a perfect ring of copper. I've welded the two ends together, so to speak. Or I've stamped it out of a great big sheet of copper. I've got this perfect ring of copper and assume I can make the copper superconductive. Now I put a magnet in the middle of that copper ring, and I now cryogenically cool the copper. Assume I can make it superconducting. I know that if I apply enough force, I can extract my magnet. But I made the copper ring superconducting while a magnetic field was present. And now I yank out that chunk of magnet. There's two ways of looking at this. Number one, there was a magnetic field there, and the copper ring will not allow any change in that magnetic field as long as that ring is superconducting. That's one way of looking at it. So there's going to be a magnetic field there. It won't allow a change. That's one way of looking at it. A second way of looking at it is the process of extracting the magnet created a current. That's the current that moved the galvanometer before. I created a current when I extracted the magnet. And now the current that I just created is going to flow forever. There's two ways of looking at it. You get the exact same answer in both ways. Do you see what I'm saying on that one, John? K2RIW.
Absolutely, Dick. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm doing so many different experiments. I wish I had more liquid cooling, more cryogenics, because I'm interested in detecting heat in magnets, which doesn't seem to exist. But that would be an interesting experiment. Have the wire there and either bring the magnet near it or swipe it, and that little bit of current should do it, and it should stay circulating. Very good.
Now, to answer Wesley's question, what does that copper look like that's cryogenically cooled at the molecular level? I'm not sure anyone knows. When you try to look at all of the articles that have been written as to what is taking place at the molecular level during superconductivity, they talk about electron pairs and molecular pairs. Somehow the individual molecules join up in pairs, and somehow the electrons flow from one molecule to the next with absolutely zero resistance.
I believe I have a partial answer, but I need Glenn just to give his opinion about the video that I have sent him.
WS1, I just saw something on one of the science shows on how they do that there.
Okay. John first, and then Paul, and then Bernie in that order. Go ahead, John.
I'll let Paul go first, Dick. I'll stand by.
WZ2HWW is a...
Go ahead, Paul. Where was that website that you saw, Paul, with the explanation of superconductivity?
They showed it not too long ago. They showed the material all, I mean, you know, molecular, you know, the, it's all animation, you know, everything's all jumbled. When they cryogenically cooled it, everything was lined up, you know, like soldiers, all the photons lined up completely straight, and then they showed, like you just mentioned, electron pairs, they go together, the spins of both electrons react to each other, so they don't go away from each other, they whip them, you know, they'll go to the pairs. They'll fly through this material and keep on going. As long as it doesn't heat up, they'll go on forever.
Lynn Carlin.
Yeah, I'd like to, when you find that website again, Paul, I'd like you to tell it to us. And by the way, one of the things I'm slowly beginning to remember is that every superconducting material has one other not-so-nice characteristic. Beyond a certain level of magnetic field, almost every superconducting material loses superconductivity. So every cryogenic superconducting material is good only up to a certain magnetic field locally to that particular piece of wire, so to speak. And so what I think is going on with the LHC magnets is they've arranged them in such a way where the magnetic field is going down the center of those coils, and the coils themselves are not... not in the middle of that magnet. They're using materials that can tolerate that particular level of local magnetic field. And there's another thing I remember seeing in one of those YouTube videos, and that is right at the threshold where the hockey puck is becoming superconducting, and you can see there is resistance where the upper magnet is starting to float. Let me drop. Well, I've seen the upper magnetic starting to float. I have seen a guy push the magnetic down, force it closer to the hockey puck, and it stayed at the new location. So in other words, there's relativity in the cryogenic superconducting phenomena. When you're right at the threshold temperature, you've got a little bit of softness to it, so to speak, where you can force a brand new magnetic field into the hockey puck, and it will allow that one to stay. So you can take a magnet that was floating, let's say, 1 inch high, you push it down to it's only a half inch high, and now it'll stay at the half inch level, when it's right at that threshold of being superconducting. How with you, Bernie? KQIO, KQLIW in the TechNet.
And I have a question, Dick.
CQ West.
KQIO here. I have nothing that I can add in this conversation. It is so far over my head. But one thing that would help a lot of us out here to follow along, could somebody post these links to the Limark email list so that the rest of us could see those videos?
CQ West.
I guess we've got to consider doing that. Although, right now, I'm not convinced very many of the Limark members really care about this jazz. I mean, it's obvious by the time, any time that John and Wesley get into these subjects on the Limark repeater, they essentially get chased off. So there's a real reluctance for people. It's only the more scientifically inclined members, and there's very few of them, that want to go this deep as I see it, Bernie. And yes, they should be put on that website. John, you had a question. Go ahead.
Comment on that.
Dick, I have a question about now current flow. Will that stop at absolute zero?
Because, Dick,
I don't think so. In other words, first of all, the word absolute zero is a relative word. You study all the cryogenic jazz, and there was a beautiful Nova on that exact subject. When we used to get down to 3 degrees Kelvin, we thought we had hit success, and then somebody got down to 2, and somebody else got down to 1. Well, I think they've gotten down to a micro Kelvin or a nano Kelvin. In other words, 0.00, 5 zeros and a 1 degrees Kelvin, and maybe 6 zeros and a 1 Kelvin. You never get to absolute zero. And they do have these techniques by which you take a molecule that's trying to move. By the way, temperature means motion. And so they can put a molecule into a trap, and by way of a feedback system with servo mechanisms and the equivalent of a microscope, you can stop that electron, you can stop that particular particle from moving. In theory, you brought that particle down to 0 degrees Kelvin. However, the word stop it from moving, again, is relative. It may be moving at a micrometer per century, if you know what I mean. So you never get to absolute zero, but I know what you're talking about. I am of the belief that most materials, you can still make electron current flow at 0 degrees Kelvin, because the 0 degrees Kelvin, let me drop.
And do you think it would be slower?
In general, the 0 degrees Kelvin means that the average amount of kinetic energy of that molecule has gone to near zero. The majority of that kinetic energy of an atom is translational speed. That's what kinetic energy, that's what a thermometer measures. You think a thermometer is measuring something called hot and cold and temperature. It's really